Oh, that's interesting. I should try that. Okay, I'll try that next time. Try that. By the way, can I get a general consensus of those who are here? It's scheduled to end at 12:15. Do people want to end at 12 rather than 12:15? Or 12? 12? Okay, we'll end at 12. I'll go on talking for another 15 minutes, but no.
Question and answer.
Yeah. Okay. All right. I think we're pretty well settled down, so I'll go on. So you've got the schematic outline, and again, it's just my interpretation of where the little subdivided headers should be to help you, if you need help, in reading the argument of the book, not just the text of it, but understanding the sections and the subsections of the book. I have to do that for myself in order to read the book as a set of directions. Sometimes so I would read the book, and it would it's so well written at times, it's so eloquent, there's sometimes those, you know, those wonderful words that Bill had when he talked, here was something at work in the human heart that had done the impossible. And you end up dwelling on words like that, and it's sort of, you forget sort of the section it's in or what it's about. Incredible. Bill had a tremendous eloquence to him. Talked about alcoholics as the children of the dark. You know, and I understand that. I was a child of the dark. I was so isolated. It's just wonderful words. So the schematic outline is just there as an interpretation and a guidance, if you need it, to where the subdivisions are for the first 102 pages or 100 and whatever it is. It's a big book. Something I wanted to talk about, cross-examining sponsees, but I can't. I may come back to that. Okay, so I've talked about the theology of the body, the obsession of the mind. I've talked about that step one is all about accepting the fact, if you are like me, the fact that you have an illness of the body, that you have an allergy of the body, or... You know, I don't use the word very much when I talk to people. I use the word cravings, uncontrollable cravings, because allergy is just, it's a word that, although I understand it now, doesn't ring true to most people because of the way the word allergy is used these days. So I use the word allergy later on as we begin to study the book with sponsees. So I'm speaking to a newcomer. I won't say I have an allergy to the body, because that'll just set their minds going on, well, if you get hives, you know, whatever. So I use the word uncontrollable cravings. And I always say, at times I get uncontrollable cravings. Not that I always get them, because my history of eating is, you know, there were times when I didn't, you know, so I just at times, I want to make it very inclusive. And the obsession of the mind, I often use the word obsession, but I just sometimes just talk about the excuses I've given in order to describe the obsession. Sometimes using words, big book words, is not the easiest way to convey the message of the book to people who don't know the book. You know, if you know the book, you've got the keywords, you know. I mean, when I first started studying the book as a set of directions, I was brought into it by a guy who had studied the big book in AA with Joe and Charlie and a guy in Manitoba, by the way, named Blaine D. In Winnipeg, my hometown, who has developed, I think, better step four forms than Joe and Charlie have used. And they've changed theirs over the years. And that's what I'm going to be talking about this afternoon. Incredible, I think, incredible step four forms. That allow you to do the steps really quickly, based completely on the big book. Joe and Charlie import the 12 and 12, and they make other interpretive decisions that, with the greatest respect to people who have saved my life, I humbly and respectfully disagree with. But Blaine also saved my life, so I use his forms. And they've been used by a lot of people. And I'm very... He's not well now, and I met with him just about a year ago, and I got permission from him to make a few changes, which are reflected in these forms, and I told him how, even though he says in AA, a lot of people don't appreciate his hardness, you know, his toughness and what he's done, I told him how many OAers around the world, and I mean around the world, have benefited from these forms. It's just been so wonderful. Anyway, on to the agnostic. The chapter we agnostics is often not read by people who are religious. They say, why should I read it? Why should I know about agnosticism? Why should I? I'm not an agnostic. I'm not an atheist. An agnostic is someone, an atheist is a person who knows there is no God. An agnostic is someone who doesn't know whether there's a God or not. So I'm an agnostic, but I'm a very skeptical agnostic who doesn't believe in a God, but I don't know that there's no God. I just don't believe in one. I'm a third generation agnostic. My grandparents came from a very religious Orthodox Jewish family in Russia, but they rejected religion early on. Although I know a lot about Judaism, I studied it a lot, and I know the prayers relatively well. Not really well, but relatively well. I just don't have any concept or connection with that. But the chapter We Agnostics has, there are two reasons why a religious person or a spiritual person should read it. One is you're going to meet people like me. And you have a duty as you recover, when you recover, to carry the message to people like me and not to exclude me from this fellowship. But in fact, to encourage me to join the fellowship and to help me get over the God thing. So you have to know the arguments in this chapter, and you have to understand why, at least with respect, I think you should understand why, the agnostic and the atheist have a place in this program. Secondly, in one part of the chapter, towards the end, there is the explanation of why you, even though you're deeply religious and deeply spiritual, if you haven't recovered, why God hasn't helped you. And if that explanation is key to an understanding of what steps 4 through 9 do. So I'll hold that in abeyance while I give you the arguments for the agnostic and the atheist. I must tell you that for years I read this. I'm a student of philosophy, and I've read all the major philosophers, and people said, oh, this is a brilliant chapter, and I would just say, this is lousy, cut-rate, second-rate, cheap philosophy. It's a lousy argument. It doesn't hold a candle to the philosophers I've read. And after a while, though, as I studied this book and began to realize its brilliance in all the other chapters, I thought, well, maybe I should, I'm not being fair to it. Maybe I should look at it, do an analysis of it, and look at the arguments and see what sense they do make. Well, you're not surprised to know that you may not be surprised to know that I do find that it has very powerful arguments. Just to start on page 44, We Agnostic, Joe and Charlie Love pointed this out. In the preceding chapters, you have learned something of alcoholism. We hope we have made clear the distinction between the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic, the compulsive eater and the non-compulsive eater. If, when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, the obsession of the mind, the inability to stop from going back. Or if when drinking you have little control over the amount you take, the allergy of the body, the fact that you can't stop once you've started, you're probably alcoholic. So you have one or the other, you probably have both. And Joe and Charlie point out, you know, AA has a pamphlet, 44 questions to decide if you're an alcoholic. OA has the 15 questions. But if really you boil it down from a big book perspective, there are only two questions. Have you experienced at times uncontrollable cravings that say more, that you can't stop even though your mind keeps wanting you to stop? Has that happened to you at times? And on the other hand, because that might be only one problem, on the other hand, have you experienced times in which, knowing that you should not go back and eat this stuff, you have gone back and eaten stuff? If your answer to either of those questions is yes, then you probably have the other. You may not have the other. I have a friend, I haven't seen him for a long time because he moved out of town, but he was my ophthalmologist and he was really quite overweight. But I hadn't seen him for a long time. I went for my annual appointment and in walks this thin man whom I did not recognize. And when he spoke, I realized it was my friend. I said, what happened? I've been trying to get him into OA for some time. He said, well, I went to see my doctor, and my doctor said about my weight. My doctor said, well, what are you eating? So I told him what I ate. My doctor said, don't eat cheese. So I stopped eating cheese. So there's a guy who probably has only the one problem, which is that once he starts eating cheese, he can't stop. He doesn't have the mind problem, which is that he keeps being persuaded to go back to eat the cheese. He knows he can't eat the cheese. Lots of sane people like that, you know, the shrimp and the peanut allergies and things like that. You can't, sane diabetics don't eat things that they shouldn't eat, right? My late mother was a diabetic, and she gave herself permission to eat all the stuff she wasn't allowed to eat. And she died so sadly. For 4 years of her life, she had a stroke, and she, you know, couldn't talk, and she had been the most wonderful, brilliant talker and just an incredibly bright light in everyone's eyes. And she tried her best, but it was hard those last 4 years. And that's what I have to look forward to if I ever go back to eating again. I will have a diabetic stroke. I will have something happening to me. I know I will get diabetes. And I know that will happen to me if I go back to eating as I used to. And if that happens to me, I know it will. I know the restrictions. I know my body will gradually wear down. I mean, I think that diabetes is one of the most, type 2, you know, you can get out of it. Many people can get out of it by simply eating well. The other thing I guess I haven't talked about, and that is, you know, it seems easier to talk, just going back to step one for a second. We, as I said, aren't as dramatic. Our deaths are not going to be dramatic either if we continue overeating. They'll be accumulative and gradually debilitating. That's the general thing we have. We're not going to suffer the sort of the happiness of the sudden heart attack. We're going to have a stroke. Well, you know, I mean, if we're really depressed, you know, I'd like to die with my feet, you know, standing up, you know. I mean, you know, my father's 95. He's in great physical shape. What he really wants to do is to die quickly. I mean, he doesn't want to die. He's happy to be alive, but he doesn't want to be dependent upon anyone else. And yet, if I went back to eating, I would gradually become more and more dependent upon other people to feed me, to bathe me, and gradually I would deteriorate from all kinds of illnesses that compulsive eating creates. I don't know if it's already become, but it certainly is on its way to becoming the single most preventable cause of death in North America. And in the United States, I mean, my goodness, you guys have an epidemic of tremendous proportion of obesity and other eating disorders. Canada's getting we're always 20 years behind you, but we're, you know, in both good and bad ways. And it's going to happen in Canada as well. So what we have to look forward to, it doesn't seem to be as serious because a bout of binge eating is not going to send us to the gutter immediately. And so the message we have to carry is one that we really have to talk about how hopeless and defeated we are, because a lot of people aren't going to take us seriously. I mean, when I say to people, and people, I've been around this healthy body weight. Sometimes I was, well, when I first started, I was higher, and then my doctor told me to lose weight, so I did. But I've been relatively healthy body weight for, well, 18 years. And people don't know me as I used to be, but those who did know me have asked me, well, what have you done? And I said, oh, I joined Overeaters Anonymous. I've seen a smirk on their face, you know. And so I'm very serious, and I do say, you know, it doesn't seem to be as serious as alcoholics. Alcoholism doesn't seem as serious as gambling, but it is. And it is a serious problem, and is one that I take as seriously as an alcoholic takes alcohol. I was brought into this program by an alcoholic member of AA who had been a gutter drunk, and had introduced me to all these gutter drunks in Winnipeg who had recovered and were the most amazing people I had ever met in my life. They had eyes you could jump into. They were so deep with understanding and love and compassion. I wanted what they had, but of course I can't drink that much, so I couldn't join AA. No, I really did want what they had. I didn't have that serenity and that peace that they had. But I'm a lifetime member of a popular weight loss program, and I'm 3 times lifetime. Each time I lost the weight, I gained it back because they gave me back the food. Yeah, you know the thing. And I was gaining food. I was gaining weight, tremendously gaining weight. After I'd done a geographic career, I left my workaholic law firm. I set up a low overhead law firm, a boutique law firm, where I didn't have to work as hard, and there was a sauna and a shower in my building. I was going to run to work and, you know, run back, shower, and then run back. Everything was going to be wonderful. And I began to gain more and more weight. I never did take a shower in that building, let alone run to work that building. And then back into my life comes this guy who had left Winnipeg and came back to visit. And I said to him, you know, Wally, I'm going to have to go back to, and I named the weight loss program. He said, why don't you try Overeaters Anonymous? I said, what's that? He said, well, it's just like Alcoholics Anonymous, except it's for people who with food problems. I said, well, never in my life have I ever had an appointment, a business appointment on a Thursday, eaten a donut on a Wednesday, and woken up in a hotel room on Friday not knowing where I was. Because those were his stories, and the stories of all the people that I had met, whom I had met. And he looked at me, and he didn't laugh. He said, if you don't start taking your food as seriously as I take my alcohol, you're going to die. And you know, coming from an alcoholic who had a life in the gutter, and my life was really good. I mean, I was surrounded at that very time. I had two kids whom I loved and who loved me. My wife loved me. I was doing well in my profession. Everything was really quite good. My parents were both healthy. Everything was terrific. My in-laws had not died. They were wonderful grandparents, and everything was really quite happy in my life. And to hear an alcoholic say to me that I have to start taking my problem as seriously gave me a sense of, yes, maybe I do deserve this. Now, I was very lucky because I'd been introduced to all these people. I wanted what they had. But we have to find a way to make it as serious. Anyway. So in We Agnostics, here's what the argument is. They give you, they start off saying, you don't have to believe in anything. Willingness is all you need. This is the revelation that Ebbie gave to Bill when Bill ranted on about religion for 2.5 pages, a couple of hours anyway. And he couldn't stand religion. He said he knew that there was a devil because the devil had him in tow, but he didn't believe in a God. And Ebbie says to him, why don't you try your own conception of God? Which was contrary, I think, to what Ebbie's group, the Oxford groups, would have thought. The Oxford groups were Protestant groups. They were people who wanted to bring people back to the Christian God of Protestantism. Catholics didn't like them very much because they believed in confession outside of the church and for all kinds of other reasons. But they're basically a Christian group. But Ebbie said, why don't you try your own conception of God? And that statement hit Bill hard, as he says. So willingness, on page 46, willingness is all that is important. A willingness to try. And step two, as it's read on the wall, the steps on the wall, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Not did believe, but came to believe. So step two describes the solution to the problem. Step one describes the problem, powerlessness. Step two describes the answer, power. The problem, despair, step one. Hope, step two. That's it. So step two is all about just the willingness to try the rest of the program. Why should you? That's the big book then goes on. And on page 47, even though this was written by Christians, and it was, I mean, some Jews had a hand in it, but and some agnostics and atheists had a hand in it, but really, it's a Christian book. The Father, there's a lot of stuff in here that's really hard for someone with a skeptical agnostic position that I had all my life to read. And I say this for the benefit, because I know in this room there are people who have the same issues I had with this. And people come up to me later and say, thank God, they say, you talked about it, because I don't feel comfortable talking about it in my group. And if that's the case, there's something wrong with the group, you know, because we've got to be inclusive. We've got to make sure that when we talk about God, that we make clear, especially to the newcomer who still suffers or those who still suffer, that they can't use the God thing as an excuse for not embracing the program. They can use other excuses, but not the God thing. So on page 47, there's a paragraph there right at the top that they're begging you that not to let your own prejudices stand in the way. It's your conception of God. Whatever language we use, it's your conception of God. Okay. So, on page 48, they start to give reasons. And they have basically three arguments for why you should be willing to try the program. It's talked about as for why you should believe in a power greater than yourself. Number one is found on page 48 through to page 51. And it's a scientific argument. It's based on the concept of science, in which science develops hypotheses, theories, and tests the theories out. And if the theories work, they accept the theories. If the testing proves to be positive, the theories are acceptable. They're accepted. They're hypotheses, they're assumptions. If they work, they work. And the Big Book's first argument is, we have a theory that if you work the steps, you will have a spiritual awakening that will give you a solution to your compulsive eating problem, to your addiction. That's our theory. Look at us. We did these. We used to be like you. We're not like you now. The only reason we're not like you now is we did the steps. Therefore, our theory works. Try it. That's a very good argument. And, you know, they give examples. We believe in electrons, although we've never seen an electron. Well, some of us may not, but most of us believe in the scientific theories that give us electric light, that give us cars, that give us internal combustion, that give us all kinds of. We believe in them. Most of us don't even know the theory behind it, but we believe that the theory behind it clearly works, that there are atoms, that there are electrons, that there's movement, that there's attraction and repulsion and whatever I learned in chemistry that's out of date. you know, we believe in those things. We believe in certain theories because they work. Here is the theory. You work the steps, you no longer have the problem. That's very strong. So that's that argument, and I won't go through it other than to point out on page 50. On one proposition, however, these men and women are strikingly agreed. That is, they all have different gods, they all have different concepts. Every one of them has gained access to and believes in a power greater than himself. This power has in each case accomplished the miraculous, the humanly impossible. That's a very important point, but it only makes its point if we happen to accept the notion that we are caught in a vicious cycle of an allergy of the body and an obsession of the mind. If we don't think that we can't stop once we start it, and if we don't think we can't stop from starting again, we are not in an impossible situation that we can't solve. If we think, oh yeah, I'll be able to stop from eating now, I just have to stop eating whatever, and I'll be fine, if we believe that, and we don't believe that we have the mind that sends us back, then what are we in OA for? Because the steps help the mind. The steps give you recovery from the mind problem. If we don't believe that there are certain foods, food ingredients, and or, could be or, eating behaviors that cause us to eat uncontrollably, or not to eat uncontrollably, uncontrollably not to eat, then why are we in this program? What is our problem? So from the Big Book perspective, you have to believe that you simply are caught in a vicious circle, or else you aren't going to feel the despair necessary to accept the theory that there's hope. Okay, that's the one argument. And I'll just go on, just because it's one of the provocations. Page 51, about five lines down. When many hundreds of people are able to say that the consciousness of the presence of God is today the most important fact of their lives, they present a powerful reason why one should have faith. Not abstinence, not sobriety. Sobriety is not the most important thing in most people's lives. It's not the most important thing in my life. Because as long as I have a conscious contact with God, I'm sane. As long as I'm sane, I don't want to eat the things that I know cause me problems. So I concentrate on my conscious contact with the God of my understanding, and I don't worry about my abstinence. I know what I can't eat. I know what the eating behaviors I can't indulge in. If I'm sane, I just won't indulge in them. That's proof number one of my provocations. Anyway, the next argument starts at page 51, and this argument is a subtle variation of the scientific theory argument, and it's based on those who are adventurous. Those who are both risk-takers and people who are psychologically incapable of accepting someone else's suggestions. And that is that you never get anywhere by trying the same things over and over again that don't work. That every progress, or you guys say progress, right? Every progress that's made in human technology and human invention has occurred by someone thinking outside the box, by someone changing the question, changing the thought, trying something different. And they use it as an example, and it's a very good example, and if I have time I'd read you the whole thing, but sometime in 1903, the New York Times published an editorial about a Dr. Langley. They mentioned Dr. Langley, who was a great scientist who tried to create a heavier-than-air flying machine and failed. It went down to the bottom of the, is it called Potomac River or Potomac, or how do we pronounce it? Potomac River. And they published an editorial, which is, why is he wasting his brilliant mind on something that will never work? While they published that thing, at the same time that that editorial was published, two bicycle repair people in North Carolina were creating a heavier-than-air flying machine. The experts all said it wouldn't work, but they thought outside the box that it worked. The example given of Galileo or Columbus, people debunk Columbus whether he really was the first person to believe that the Earth was round. But the concept that the Earth was round was a concept that a lot of people rejected in his time, and he just said, well, let me try something different. So the ability to try something different is the hallmark of an experimenter who's willing to try different hypotheses and different theories. Why aren't you trying something different? It ain't working for you. What you're doing isn't working for you. That's a strong argument. I think it's a strong argument anyway. I'll come back to these bedevilments, but on page 52, they list a series of eight things that are going wrong. They're probably going wrong in your life if you're like me, and saying, so you're doing the same thing over and over again, and it's not working. Why aren't you trying something new? And on page 52 at the bottom, they then start to work on undercutting the skeptical, rational person's reliance on reason and skepticism. You'll never find anyone more skeptical than I, although you'll find a lot of people more cynical than I. Skepticism means that, to me, it has to be proven. And I'm very skeptical about all kinds of things. Don't get me onto things that are non-OA, because they start on bottom page 52 to say a few things. First of all, logic is wonderful, but you can't prove logic unless you use logic to prove logic. Therefore, you assume logic to be valid in order to use it. And that's philosophically absolutely true. You can't prove anything without using logical concepts. If you can't prove anything without using logic, therefore logic is a tool that you believe in. It's not an absolute thing that can be proven at all. You can't prove logic. That's strong. That's good. They say 53, you're squarely confronted with the question of faith. You can't duck the issue. This is, again, some of that language. It's so powerful. Some of us had already walked far over the bridge of reason toward the desired shore of faith. The outlines and the promise of the new land had brought luster, shine, and aura and polish to tired eyes and fresh courage to flagging spirits. Friendly hands had stretched out in welcome. We were grateful that reason had brought us so far. So this is the reason that brings us. I'm hopeless. There's hope. That's the reason that's bringing it. That seems reasonable. I'll test out this theory. But somehow we couldn't step ashore. Perhaps we've been leaning too heavily on reason that last mile, and we did not like to lose our support. It's the concept of the leap of faith, this concept of what's going to get me to try to leap over to the other side. There's a gap between my reason bringing me here and my willingness and my ability to go on to the other side. There's a whole interesting segue I could do but won't do about philosophy of the leap of faith. To me, it's interesting, but don't have time. The leap of faith. Well, they go down, 53. And here's where they absolutely killed me. This is, for me, the best argument. And this argument is basically from 53 to the bottom, page 54. And that is, you know what? You're really hypocritical. To say that you believe in logic and reason and nothing else is so contrary to your life experience. Because the most important things in your life are things you cannot prove at all. You cannot prove to be true at all. Love. Love isn't logical. You know, both my children, I was there at the birth of both of them, and I held them in my arms after, a minute of life. I'd die for them. I knew I would. I knew the moment I held them, I would die for them. That I had a bond with them. That's not logical. It's not reasonable. And when one of them became 12, it was no longer... I regretted my decision. But now she's the sweetest kid in the world now. She's no longer a kid, and she gave birth to the nicest, most wonderful grandchild. We just had a grandson, and she's a middle school teacher now, so she knows all the tricks that she used to play on us. See. But I knew I'd die for her. I knew I'd die for my wife, and I'd like to think I'd die for other people or things I believe in. I'd like to think I would. But it's certainly true that I would have died for them. And it wasn't logical that a one-minute-old child is more important than I was at that particular time, at that particular moment. You know, I was doing good things, and I was more capable of doing good things than my one-minute-old child was. It's not a logical thing to say that she's more important than I am. But I couldn't say she wasn't. She was more important. She is more important than I am. And so I do believe in something that I cannot justify by logic at all. And that's where that for me is the strongest argument, because I believe in things. I believe, well, my first sponsor, when I was handed this stuff, I said, what about this God thing? My first sponsor asked me a really simple question. Is there anything you believe in that is more important than you are? And love immediately came to my mind. Immediately. It was so easy for me to say, yes, I would die for my children, I would die for my wife, and I'd like to think I would even die for other people. I'd like to think. I've never been faced with that, but I'd like to think. And as I began to analyze it, whether I'd have the courage to die for these things, I don't know, but I think that truth is more important than I am, love is more important than I am, justice is more important than I am, and because I happen to love incredibly things that give me aesthetic experiences, I think beauty is more important than I am. I know I give up some fingers to be able to have composed what Johann Sebastian Bach composed. I don't know if I give up my whole life, but I think I'd feel pretty content if I had composed even three things that Bach composed. So I was able to say to my sponsor, yes, truth, love, justice, and beauty are more important than I am. And he said, call it God. I said, I can't call that God. God has a personality. God is something that interferes with the space-time continuum that sort of changes things. God finds parking spots for those people in the meetings. You know, I mean, I don't believe in that at all. He said, good early direction, whatever you want to call it. And I had to work on that. And I thought to myself, okay, the direction, okay. Now, there are two kinds of directions that you can get. One is the directions that you get from people about how to go from point A to point B. And that's, many religious people have that kind of direction from their God. It comes from their scriptures or from their interpreters of scriptures, their own clergy people or things of that sort. It comes from the grace that they have in fellowship that pushes them forward and gives them directions. That's a direction, in a sense, pushing from behind. But there's another kind of direction, and that's a compass. And I tried to imagine true north, or true magnetic north, I guess, on a compass, 360 degrees of directions. One direction is true magnetic north. 359 other directions are Laurie's way. That made sense to me. So I said, okay, I can accept the notion that truth, love, justice, and beauty are directions I want to go in rather than my way. I want to live in the path of truth, love, justice, and beauty. That's what I want to live in. And I wasn't living that way, the way I wanted to live. That's, for me, how I got over that issue. I don't think it matters how you get over it. What matters is the concept that you're not being asked at step two to believe in anything other than to accept the notion that there are people in this program who were once like you and are no longer like you, and the only way they changed was to do the steps. And that's all you have to accept, that there is hope. Because the promise of this program comes after step nine, which is that halfway through step nine and after step nine, you will believe in something, and you will have a direct connection with that. But you don't have to believe in anything right now. You simply have to have the hope that working the steps will give you something, and you don't even have to know what it is, other than you have to believe that it gives you freedom from the bondage that you're in of the food. If you can believe in that, how it's accomplished is completely irrelevant. No, How it's accomplished is completely irrelevant. That's the steps. What accomplishes it is completely irrelevant. They work. I'll stop there. Anyone wants to talk about that, I'd be happy to talk about. But I now want to talk about the page that really pinpoints our particular problem, whether we're religious or spiritual or not. And I'll start off with simply telling a story about a friend of mine who was in OA and left Winnipeg and joined a very, very strong church program. Very strong. I'm not going to characterize it any further. And believed, without asking, that the 12-step program would be discouraged by the pastor of her particular church. Never asked the pastor, but believed it. I personally don't believe it. I believe that almost any religion would welcome the 12 steps, but I may be wrong. Anyway, and she's put on so much weight. She used to be very thin, and she came back to Winnipeg, and I was talking to her. I said to her, your problem is that although you believe in God, you've blocked God off from you. She said, how do you know? How did you know that? I said, well, let's read this passage in the big book together, shall we? On page 55. Actually, the second full paragraph there. Actually, we were fooling ourselves. For deep down, in every man, woman, and child, is the fundamental idea of God. And remember, they've already said, God is your conception, not anyone else's. I prefer to think of God in this particular paragraph as being whatever I deeply believe in. I deeply believe in truth, love, justice, and beauty. Other people deeply believe in the God of the Bible or the Allah of the Quran. It doesn't matter. I deeply believe in something. That's God. It may be obscured, blocked off. That's what obscure means. It may be obscured, blocked off by calamity, bad things happening to us, by pomp, a sense of self-importance, or by worship of other things, money, other people's opinions of us, concern about our reputation. But in some form or other, it is there. For faith in a power greater than ourselves and miraculous demonstrations of that power in human lives are facts as old as man himself. We finally saw that faith in some kind of God was a part of our makeup, just as much as the feeling we have for a friend. Sometimes we have to search fearlessly, a searching and fearless moral inventory. But he was there. He was as much a fact as we were. We found a great reality deep down within us. In the last analysis, it is only there that he may be found. It was so with us. The picture, the metaphor is, we are people who believe in something, but what we believe in deep in our hearts is blocked off by things that have happened in our lives and our own needs, our own wishes, our own wants, our own desires. And we have to search fearlessly and unblock that connection. So the deeply religious person, as well as the deeply skeptical person who believes in something, has to unblock the connection between what we believe in and how we think and how we act. That's the picture. And we'll find that is picked up again in the step forward, description of what step forward does. Because we have to get rid of the things that block us from the sunlight of the Spirit. So this whole picture is so powerful that the purpose of steps 4 through 9, I'll talk about why 4 through 9 is the inventory, not just 4, from the big book this afternoon. But the purpose of that inventory, you say process, I say process. The purpose of the inventory process is to unblock the course, the vein, the artery, whatever you want to call it, between what's in our hearts and how we think and how we act. And that's what the big book promises us. In step 11, they'll tell us we begin to act intuitively. We're looking for what Bill calls the fourth dimension of human existence, which is that we act without thinking. Because we can trust the connection. And that connection is putting power into us. And that power is pushing us in one direction only, and that's the direction of our higher power, rather than the direction of our way. As we get into step 3, and I don't mind talking about it now, we'll see that the description of our problem in how it works is completely a description of our way. That our problem is we want our way. And what we are striving for is to get rid of wanting our way and wanting to have the way pointed out to us by what we deeply believe in. So for both the religious and the non-religious and the atheist and the agnostic, all the steps do, really simply, is get rid of the things that block us from what we believe in, deeply believe in. And that, you can call God if you want, you can call it higher power, you can call it what you deeply believe in, that's all it is. And that gives you the personality change sufficient to overcome compulsive eating. I think it's very simple, and I think that we often make it so complicated in this program. It's a very simple picture, and that's why the Big Book is able to say with some certainty, it is simple but not easy. There are things we have to do, but it's a simple picture. You know, I love the Big Book because I happen to love the directions of the Big Book for doing the steps. But I tell you, there's one reason for loving the Big Book, whether or not you follow its directions, and that is its picture of the problem and the solution. I don't think we do a good job in OA of describing the problem or the solution. And I think because of that, we lose newcomers because we do not explain clearly how simple this program is. We call it simple but not easy, but we explain it in a complicated way. You know, I was just talking over supper yesterday about our invitation to you. It's a wonderful thing. I've seen people cry over it. Welcome to Overeaters Anonymous, welcome home. But there's a point after the reading of the 12 steps. Can we promise you this recovery? For me, the answer to that question should be, well, yes. Of course we could promise you this recovery if you're like us and if you do what we did. But the answer says, if you follow the program, if you read the 12 steps, I don't know how long it goes on for a whole paragraph, then we think you can join us on our journey. You know, so it's sort of a longer way of saying what can be said very briefly. You know, the famous statement by, I forgot who said it, I don't even know who said it, I'm sorry I didn't have time to write you a shorter letter. You know, and for me, I think the Big Book is the shorter letter in many ways, but at least it's the description program. Okay. So that's step two. And it's not a step we take. It's a step we accept. Yes, I am willing. So step one is an acknowledgement of our situation and a defining of our plan of eating. And by the way, I do recommend the pamphlets Plan of Eating and the pamphlets Dignity of Choice as ways of working that through. You develop, you get abstinent, you get sober, you're in a race. Because your mind's going to get you. Your mind is going to get you soon if you don't do something about it. And step two is simply, I have hope. I'm willing to do what's necessary to change. It's really that simple. At least I think from the Big Book perspective. It's simple, but you have to spend a lot of time thinking clearly about where you are so you feel that despair and you accept that hope. Step three. Step three did not exist in the original six steps. Bill put it in as a loophole, to plug a loophole. And I think that loophole is easily there. It's a moment in time. As we'll see, it's a moment in time where you say, yes, I am ready. I am ready. And I know what it means to be ready. Much of step of chapter 5, before we get to step 4, is talking about what it means to make the decision to turn our life and our will over to the care of God. And again, I hope you find in that schematic outline some helpful outline of exactly what it is, how the Big Book is structured. Because step three is made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood it. Well, first they discuss will, and then they discuss lives. And they don't say that, but they do, and I'll show you where it comes. I know you those of you in Los Angeles have John Kay who has a wonderful joke about what an order, I can't go through with it, on page 60. If you haven't heard it, ask him, because he's hilarious. He's a great comedian. But anyway, on page 60, Says our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear. And by the way, many of you have heard of the manuscript of the big book. It was written before it was sent out, a year before the book was published. 400 copies were made, and people gave critiques of it and suggested changes. One major change made was it used to say, you should do this, you should do that, you must do this, and it was changed to, we did this, you know, a major change, a huge way of including me rather than saying, I'm different from you, you've got to do this, you know, it's a wonderful change. But anyway, at this point, the manuscript said, our personal adventures before and after have been designed to sell you three pertinent ideas. I'm glad they took that away. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. C, that God could and would if he were sought. And then the manuscript used to say, or did say, if you are not convinced, then either reread this book or throw it away. Now that's a toughness, and I'm not so sure I sort of missed that. Anyway, being convinced, we were at step three, which is that we decided to turn our will and our life over to God as we understood him. What do we mean by that? And what do we do? So the big book is saying we're going to talk about first what we mean by it, and then we're going to talk about what we do. So the bottom page 60 to the middle of page 63 is what we mean by it. And then page 63, the step three prayer is basically two paragraphs. And then we get into step four. That's at least how I read it, but you can disagree with me, but that's how I read it. And then if you look at pages 60 to the bottom of 62, that's the will and the lives. The will is found at the bottom of page 60, going to the last paragraph on page 62. And I'll talk about that first. That's will, and then they talk about lives. So what does it mean to turn our will over? Well, they say the first thing we have to do is understand, be convinced, that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. I remember where I was when that paragraph was first pointed out to me. I had read it already, but my sponsor pointed out to me. I remember the restaurant we were in. I remember where I was sitting. Because it resonated with me in a way that it just absolutely punctured my bubble. We are, the big book says, like actors who want to be the directors and the producers of the stage play, that musical. And what's important to understand from the description the big book gives is it could even be the best of motives. It's not as if our motives have to be bad to want that. It's not as if we want to be the star of the show. We just want the show to be good. And we know how it could be better. And the big book goes on and says our motives could be, we may be, on page 61, we may be virtuous. We may be kind, considerate, patient, generous, even modest and self-sacrificing. And I can tell you that I think if you ask most of my friends, not my wife, before I joined this program, to describe me as I appeared to be, I think that they would have said that I was kind, considerate, patient, generous, and self-sacrificing. Not modest, but kind, considerate, generous, patient, and self-sacrificing. My motives were generally good. I grew up really coddled. I've had a wonderful, blessed life. I've had difficult things, deaths and sadnesses in my life, but generally I did not struggle with life. I've been fortunate enough to have to live within a very powerful family that fed me, gave me love and too much food, but gave me all the food I wanted. I've had a great education, luckily, and all that. But I'm Jewish, and I grew up in the 50s, and the Holocaust weighed on me all my life. I just recently gave away, I don't know how many boxes of books on the Holocaust, which I've accumulated over the years trying to understand it. And I want you to understand, I am not one who just says, oh, just 6 million Jews were killed. 12 million, approximately 12 million people were killed for reasons that had nothing to do, well, that were horrible. And there have been other Holocausts and other horrible things happening to humanity, but I grew up with this sense of social guilt. I survived. And as a Jew, you meet a lot. In the 50s, met a lot of Holocaust survivors, and made me feel even more guilty. And so I've been obsessed with wanting life to be different. I don't like injustice in our lives. I don't like the fact that people are dying and that people are being tortured and that people are killing each other and whatever. I just don't like it. I don't like it. I can't live with it. It's just, it is all my life. It's paralyzed me. But my motives are virtuous. I mean, I was living a good life, but I didn't like what was going on. So that's what they say. On the other hand, he may be mean, egotistical, selfish, and dishonest. Well, there were some relationships I had in which that was absolutely true for me. You know, even both with my wife and before my wife, I was in some relationships. But as with most humans, he's more likely to have varied traits. What I want to emphasize is that from the Big Book's perspective, our problem is that we want our way, and it doesn't matter whether our motives are virtuous, not virtuous, or a mixture. Because the Big Book is going to start defining the word selfish to include a definition that is different from the definition you'll find in every dictionary. And I think it's really important, because we use the word selfish later on in step 4, and if we don't understand the word selfish in step 3, or the description in step 3, we will not understand how to do a good step 4 inventory the Big Book way. Selfish, the Big Book is saying, and I'm not going to read every paragraph to prove it, but selfish means wanting my way rather than the way it is, or wanting my way rather than God's way, for those who are religious. It just means wanting something different and wanting life to be different, whatever my motives, whether my motives are good, bad, or a mixture. That's all it means. And the Big Book goes on, and I'm not going to read the whole thing, but it's very powerful. What is his basic trouble, middle of page 61? Is he not really a self-seeker even when trying to be kind? Is he not a victim of the delusion that he can rest? There's another wonderful word. He can grab satisfaction and happiness out of this world if he only manages well. Is it not evident to all the rest of the players that these are the things he wants? And do not his actions make each of them wish to retaliate, snatching all they can get out of the show? I remember sponsoring, well, it didn't last very long, sponsoring a woman, the nicest person in the world. And I got her through the book, we were reading the book, and I said, so I talked about selfishness, and she said, but I'm not selfish. I want my children to do the right thing. And it's not for my own need. I want them to do the right thing so they'll be happy. She couldn't get over the definition of the word selfish that she grew up with and that most of us have grown up with. And it's too bad the Big Book uses the word selfish to describe it, but it's how the Big Book describes it. I can't prove it completely, but I can show you. I mean, if you look at the bottom page 61, top page 62, you'll see a whole bunch of examples of what the Big Book will call selfish. Some of them are virtuous and some of them are not. Page 62. Selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles, driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. These are definitions of selfishness? Yes, in the Big Book perspective. We step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt us. This is a sentence I want to parse. Sometimes they hurt us seemingly without provocation, but we invariably find that at some time in the past we've made decisions based on self which later placed us in a position to be hurt. Charlie does a really good discussion of that, because of course you can read that and say, oh, so I was raped as a kid and I deserve it because I dressed provocatively, or what? What are you saying here? I made decisions based on self. No, Charlie says, that's not what it could possibly mean. He says, when he was 8 years, he said, he passed away this last year, I think. He said, when I was 8 years old, my father beat me black and blue. No 8-year-old child deserves to be beaten black and blue. But if 50 years later, with a father long dead, I'm still being beaten up in my mind, then clearly I made decisions based on self in the past that place me now in a position to continue to be hurt. And that's true. And I've been lucky in my life, never suffered the kind of abuse that friends of mine have, but I've had friends in this program who have suffered horrible, horrible things as kids. And they understand that sentence perfectly. They have allowed the past to continue to hurt them. That's the decision they made. I wish life were not true. Hey, I didn't want Hitler to have existed, and yet Hitler died before I was born. I don't accept reality. You know, that selfishness, the Big Book description. I think it's a very important thing to say, just in case anyone misunderstands that. So our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. I've heard it described as I trouble. They arise out of ourselves, and the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot, though he usually doesn't think so. I mean, think of us, not the stereotypical alcoholic who goes out and changes things and cheats and lies and steals and breaks things and stumbles and breaks up families, but think of us as the isolated, self-pitying people who sit in the basement watching TV, you know, bringing the food to our mouths and saying, oh, what could have been? Or, oh, what should be? Or, oh, if only? Or, what if? But that's the same person that's described here. The person who wishes life would go his or her way and not the way it did. And the person ultimately is paralyzed by that because it's blocking us from the sunlight of the Spirit, from the things we deeply believe in. So that's our description. They go on. Above everything, we alcoholics must be rid of this selfishness. Again, selfishness in a very broad way. We must, or it kills us. God makes that possible. I hate reading that. You know, I mean, as an agnostic, as a, you know, God makes that possible. What do you mean? Okay, I have to translate. I'm going to get my directions from pulling towards rather than from the bush behind. If I can connect with what I believe in, then that's my higher power, which makes it possible for me to accept the way things are and to realize, what? The simple things. That I can only change what I can change and to accept that. That I can't change other things. There often seems no way of entirely getting rid of self without his aid. Many of us have moral and philosophical convictions galore, but we could not live up to them even though we would have liked to. Hit me in the eyes. I believed in all kinds of things which I wasn't living according. I wasn't living according to them. I believed in truth, love, justice, and beauty. I was being unbeautiful. I was living an unbeautiful life. I was doing unbeautiful things. I was lying to others and myself about all kinds of stuff. I wasn't being just. I was blaming some people for things that I should have blamed myself for. You know? These were things. And where was the love I showed when I yelled and screamed at not just my kids for my mistakes? I mean, my brilliant older kid at the age of 6 said, just because you had a bad day at work didn't mean you had to take it out on me. My kid was precocious. My wife is a social worker, and she worked in the school division, and although she never worked in the same school that my daughter was at, she got a call from the guidance counselor at my daughter daughter's school. He said, "Help." And my wife said, "What's wrong?" Your daughter was in to my office, and she looked at the books on my desk, and she said, "Oh, those aren't any good. You should read the ones my mother has. I'll bring them to you." She's 12 years old. And as a matter of fact, we would buy a book and she would say to us a day after we bought it, "That's not going to work on me." She would have read it. She's a speed reader, you know. Anyway, all right, we have to have God's help. So that's all the will problem. Our problem is our will. We want our will. We want what we want when we want it. That's our problem. For good or bad motives, for justifiable or not justifiable motives. I mean, my friends didn't want to be raped or be victims of incest. I mean, they didn't want that, and they have every reason not to want that. What a horrible, horrible, sad, tragic, terrible thing to happen, brutal thing to happen. But it happened. And they didn't want the past to have occurred. And they understand what this means, to live a life based on self-will. Much more than me. You know, I appreciate that, but they are the examples of courage and recovery to me that I cannot possibly provide to you. I have their permission to talk about some of their examples when we get to step 4. But for me, that whole concept is, I mean, I didn't want life to go as badly as it was going for me, which wasn't that bad, you know. I wanted some lawyers I dealt with to be nicer. Big deal, you know. But other people wanted, I didn't want the Holocaust to occur, which I think is a big thing. But I didn't suffer from the Holocaust. No one in my family suffered from the Holocaust. We, you know, my family came over in the early 1900s. So, but however we feel, it doesn't matter. You know, whatever has happened to us as individuals, or whatever has happened to us, or whatever our feeling is, we want life to be different. So that's the will problem. To turn our will over. And then they say that's the how and why of it, page 62. First of all, we have to quit playing God. We have to quit playing God. We have to quit being in charge of life. That's the will problem. Still the will. We have to quit playing God. It didn't work. Clearly it didn't work. Next, this is now the lives problem. We have the will, now it's the lives. We decided to thereafter in this drama of life, so we're talking about life, God was going to be our director. In other words, whatever, and again, he was the father, he's the father, we're the children, he's the principal, we're the, what is it, he's the principal, we're his agents. I mean, language that is all anthropomorphic and difficult for me to sort of read, but I do read it and I do accept it when I make my own substitutions for with truth, love, justice, and beauty. Yes, I want to live my life and be connected to the power that I get from what I deeply believe in. That's what I want. Therefore, I have to give up trying to be the power in life. I can't do it. And I have to devote my life to a life based on truth, love, justice, and beauty. For me. Maybe something different for you. Maybe a particular kind of God. So I have to accept that. That's the idea. I have to give up playing God. I'm turning over my will. And I have to live a life according to what I deeply believe in. Turn over my life. And that's step three. That's what I have to do. On page 63 are what some people think are the promises of step three. They aren't. They're the promises of what happens when you have turned your will and your life over to the care of the God of your understanding. I'll prove that in two ways. One is by reading page 63. When we sincerely took such a position, and that means, I think, working the steps, all sorts of remarkable things followed. We had a new employer. Now, you don't get your job description in this program until you've recovered. On page 102, you get your job description. Our job now is to be of maximum usefulness to others. You aren't fit to be of maximum usefulness to others until you've gone through the training program and recovered. Big Book makes that very, very clear. You can't be useful if you have nothing to give. Go on. Being all powerful, he provided what we needed if we kept close to him and performed his work well, steps 4 through 12. Established on such a footing, not starting off, but established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs. More and more, we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life. As we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, as we discovered we could face life successfully, as we became conscious of his presence, we began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, or the hereafter. We were reborn. This is not the promise of step three. This is the promise of the entire program. I'll prove it by going below to page 63, right towards the bottom. The only promise made after you say the prayer, which is step three, is this was only a beginning. Though if honestly and humbly made, an effect, sometimes a very great one, was felt at once. It's the only promise of step three. You feel an effect, and sometimes it's a great one. That's the only promise of step three. I say that because many people read our OA 12 and 12 step three. I'm not saying it should be read this way, but many people read it as saying, if you don't feel God come into you at step three, you can't go on to step 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. I'm not suggesting it says that, but I know it can be read that way. And I've heard lots of people say, well, God hasn't entered into my life yet, so I'm not worthy of going on. And if any part of the OA 12 and 12 is used as an excuse for not going on with the steps, then that's the excuse that's allowing the mind to send you back to the food. And I've watched a lot of people read our OA 12 and 12 and try to follow its directions. I think misinterpreting it, but whatever. And stopping at certain points and saying, I'm not ready yet to go on to the next step. And they relapse. I'll tell a few jokes and then we'll do step three. All these jokes have a purpose. I have only one original joke and I'll tell it in step four. All the rest are sort of within the AAOA stratosphere. You all know this one. Three frogs are sitting on a log and two frogs make a decision to jump off. After 5 minutes, how many frogs are left? And people say, one, and then they, oh no, that's a trick, yeah, all three of them, because the other frog would have jumped when the other two jumped, and the answer is really none jumped, because they only made a decision. Yeah, no, you've heard of that one. A guy falls off a cliff, And he's holding, you know, it's just like Sergeant Snorkel and Bill Bailey, you know, he's holding on to the one twig on the side of the cliff. And he says, God, I've never prayed before, but if there's a God, please help me. And a voice says, I'm here, my son. What? I'm here, my son. God, is that you? Yes, my son. Oh, thank you, God. God, what do I do? What do I do? Let go of the twig. Pardon me? Let go of the twig. Don't ruin my punchline, please. Is there anyone else up there? A man is on the board of a very important charity. He's a man of little means. And the charity is defrauded by, say, the treasurer, and is out a lot of money, and if it doesn't have any money, it will have to go bankrupt. And no one has the money to put it in. It took him years to develop this money. And he's a very religious man. And he gets on his knees. He goes to his modest bedroom. He gets on his knees. He says, God, I've never asked you for myself for anything, and I'm not asking you for myself now. But this charity, which is a very wonderful charity, needs money. And the only answer is to win the lottery. Now, I'm not asking to win the $1 million or the $49 million. $100,000, two numbers. That's all I need. You know, and I'm just asking for that. And I'm going to pray for 18 hours a day. I'm going to eat bread and drink water. Well, if his men would go away, he wouldn't have eaten bread. Anyway. That's a joke. I may not stop the show, but I sure do slow it down. Anyway, so he does this. And you can make it longer, but it's Saturday, and he's praying. It's, God, this is it. 3 hours, and they're going to pull the numbers. Please, God, please help me. Please, you know. And suddenly, beautiful sunny day outside, clouds roll in from nowhere, big, back, dark clouds that cover the entire sky, and so much of the streetlights go on because it's just dark, and there's the sound of lightning, and then there's this thunder, but there's no rain, and the wind starts up, and it's just a scary moment, and suddenly a shaft of sunlight shines down on this man's face, and a frustrated voice says, buy a ticket! Okay, I have another joke. It's the guy sitting on the porch, and a police car comes up to him and says, Frank, get in. There's going to be a flash flood, and you're going to be, and the whole house is going to be submerged. Get in. No, I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand it. Okay, police car drives off. The flood comes. He's on the second floor. A boat comes by. Get in, Frank. It's going to get worse. No, I made a decision to turn my will and my life over. He's now on the roof. He's holding on to his... Some of you have heard of television antennas. He's holding on to the television antenna. A helicopter drops a ladder, you know, come on. No, I've made a decision. And he drowns. And he goes to heaven, and he brushes past St. Peter. He says, I want to talk to the big guy. He speaks to God, where were you? And God says, I sent you a police car, I sent you a boat, and I sent you a helicopter. A decision is only a decision. I can make a decision to come to Los Angeles, but if I don't buy a ticket and get on the plane, I'm not going to be in Los Angeles. It's only a decision. This is not part of the original six steps. It is not something that was imparted by Dr. Bob or by Bill. It was put in by Bill to make it an awesome moment. It's the moment that Dr. Bob always had. I mean, Dr. Bob was a saint. Dr. Bob was the co-founder of AA, and everyone thought of him as a saint after he stopped drinking. And his method of working the steps was very religious, quite Christian actually, but he was also the kind of charismatic man, or person, who if he said something, you just sort of would follow him blindly, and Bill did too. Bill's love and admiration for Bob was incredible, because Bill knew that he had all kinds of flaws that Dr. Bob did not. Dr. Bob was a selfless man. And so Dr. Bob would say, all right, are you ready to come on this journey or not? And that's the equivalent of step three. Now that you understand what it's going to mean, that you're going to have to give up wanting to be in charge of life and find a method by which the blocks between you and what you believe in are going to be eradicated, eliminated. You're going to try and live according to what you believe in rather than live according to what you want out of life. Are you ready to go forward? And that's what step three is. It's a very important moment in your life because you're saying, yes, I am ready. the big book sometimes says, there's one place where it says, yes, I must have these things. And that whole notion of wanting to change your life is what's important at step three. That's all. So let's say it. It's found. It's just a prayer. It's not just a prayer. It's a very important prayer. Let's say it together. 63. God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. Always. Now, here's the first intimation that our purpose in doing the steps is not for the purpose of getting better ourselves. That our getting better ourselves is now going to become an object of hope for other people, just as the people who brought the message to us became an object of hope for us. That's our job. Take away my difficulties. Why? So I don't have to eat anymore? So that I'll be happy? No. So that overcoming your difficulties will help others appreciate the love and the power and the way of life of this program. It's the first hint that this is going to happen. That's step three. And I venture to think that I hope I've shown, that it doesn't take a lot if you accept your powerlessness, step one, you adopt a plan of eating and you become abstinent, you know you're at a race because you've got that mind problem, you accept in step two that other people have been like you and have a solution that you have not, and you want to try that solution, and you accept as a prelude to step three that your problem is you want life to be different. And you have to get rid of that wish to have life be different. And then you do step three, and the big book says, and I'm going to stop this, next we launched out, we propelled ourselves from the dock with enormous force. We launched ourselves out on a course of vigorous action. We're going to talk about action from now on. We're not going to talk about thinking and sitting around. Am I ready? Am I not ready? What am I going to do? We're going to do something. And in doing something, we are going to recover. Not by thinking, but by doing. And that's what we're going to find out. And I'm going to talk about that. Just a preview then. I'm going to hand out, before we come back at 2, I'm going to hand out step 4 forms that I think you'll find to be really good. Step 8 and 9 forms, I'll say step 11 for tomorrow. I'm going to talk about steps 4 through 9 almost as a whole, and I'll talk about why that is. I may get on to step 10 today because I want to spend more time tomorrow on step 12, which for me is a very important step. Joe and Charlie never got to step 12. They always sort of didn't peter out, but they ran out of time around step 9 and 10. I mean, there were times when they did step 12, but hardly. I want to spend a lot of time on 12. AA doesn't need our help. It doesn't need the help as much as OA needs help in carrying the message. I think that's about it. So I will stop. Thank you. Pardon me? Oh, no, I'll hand out the stuff tomorrow, in the morning, when we come back. Okay?